You're listening to Zentertainment Talk Radio with Joe Davidson here on the web at www.zentertainment.org. If this is your first time or you're still not signed up for the newsletter, please do that because I'd love to keep in touch with you. It's free and you can do that on the main page at zentertainment.org. I have a fantastic guest for you on the show today, one of my favorite people. His name is Dr. Larry Dossey, and he's an internist, a former chief of staff of Medical City Dallas Hospital. He's written a lot of books on medicine, the role of mind-body, prayer, and health. And his latest book, this brand new book, which you can pick up a copy at your local bookstore, this book is called The Power of Premonitions, How Knowing the Future Can Shape Our Lives. Now, how many of you out there have ever had a dream or a nagging feeling about something, and then it actually happened in real life? Something you couldn't have possibly known about, but you did somehow. How many of you have ever had a pet that somehow was able to sense illness or comfort you or even find you? Say the pet was lost and was able to find you even across thousands of miles. We're going to be talking about all these things and more in today's show. You know, one of the things that kind of trips me up sometimes is I have a lot of daydreams, and most of them never happen. So how do you know when something's a true premonition, when that nagging feeling, that dream, that daydream, when it's something you need to really heed, you know, listen to, versus something that's just kind of there floating around, coming in, going out? How do you know the difference? Larry's going to talk a little bit about that. And he's also going to tell us about something that just completely changed his viewpoint, turned him upside down. When he was first practicing medicine, he had a premonition. It was so vivid, so real, and it came true.
How you doing?
I'm good. I'm a busy boy these days. Life is an airplane. I'm on a book tour, but that's not a complaint. I'm happy to be doing it.
It's really similar to touring as an artist, you know? It's nonstop.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No kidding.
Well, I have a lot of questions regarding this book, and I really loved it. The Power of Premonitions. I want to tell all of you listening, The Power of Premonitions, How Knowing the Future Can Shape Our Lives. Why are so many premonitions not accurate? How do you know the difference between a premonition and just a daydream?
Well, you know, I think just like we have clutter in our minds during the day, which amount to virtually nothing. It's just mental noise, much of it is. It's the same with premonitions. Just like we can have false memories of the past, we can have erroneous impressions of the future. Just because something pops into our minds doesn't mean that it's going to be valid. And that may seem negative toward premonitions, but I don't really think it is. There really are some rules of thumb which help us distinguish valid premonitions from those that turn out to be just fantasies. For example, if you talk to people who are really gifted at premonitions, they usually talk about the numinosity of their premonition. And that's a word that just simply means touched by the divine in its literal meaning. What people mean when they say that is that a premonition that turns out to be valid seems realer than real often. It just seems hyper-real. It just seems lit up with significance when you experience it. I remember when I was just sort of knocked off my feet with these things back when I first entered the practice of medicine. I had a premonition one night which proved to be camera-like in detail, which at that moment I thought was the most realistic dream I've ever had in my life.
Now, was that the one in your book you wrote about during your first year of medical practice?
Yeah, it absolutely unnerved me. I didn't think the world could work like that at the time.
Would you mind sharing that with everybody?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I dreamt one night that of the 4-year-old son of one of my colleagues, one of my medical colleagues, and he was lying on an examination table, and his mother was standing by him. There was a technician at his head who was trying to perform some sort of test on him. I didn't know what the test was, but I did know the technician in real life. She was an EEG, a brainwave technician, and he had the reputation of having a really nice way with children, a special talent with children. But this wasn't working this time. This kid just went berserk. This is all in the dream. And he started screaming, kicking, fighting. He would not let the technician do whatever it was she wanted to do with him. So in the dream, she threw up her hands and turned around and walked away and said, "I quit." And I thought that was one of the strangest dreams I'd ever had. It was certainly one of the most vivid and realistic. I started to wake my wife up and tell her about it, but I thought, you know, that it just doesn't mean anything. It has no significance. So I got up and went to work, and I made rounds at the hospital and saw patients all morning. And at noon, I was lunching in the luncheon area with this doctor, the father of this young boy, and in walks his wife carrying this child, and he's crying, and his hair is wet, and she proceeds to tell her husband essentially my dream.
They'd
just come from the brainwave laboratory, and the technician tried to do this test on him, and she described how he just went berserk, and technician just quit, and there it was. And I didn't know what to make of that. And
yeah, when you heard it right then, I mean, were you very close to, I didn't get the feeling you were real close to this child or knew him that well, right?
I hardly knew him. You know, maybe we'd seen him three or four times in his entire life, which made it even stranger.
Yeah.
I actually talked to the doctor, the father of this child, and I told him my dream, and he was as unnerved as I was. He wouldn't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Both of us knew that, you know, our worldview had suddenly been rearranged, and he never brought it up again, ever. He just sort of put the lid on it and refused to deal with it.
Well, that's the thing. Some of these things are scary because you don't know what to do with this stuff, right?
Well, you know what Rumi said? Rumi once said, sell your cleverness and buy bewilderment.
Bewildered.
Another clue, aside from their numinosity or their realer-than-real quality, is whether or not they're recurrent. In the book, I talk about a woman who had a dream every night for a year, and she didn't have a clue about what it meant. Because in the dream, a nurse was shining a light on her lower leg as if to illuminate or indicate something. And a year later, she erupted in a bone infection that required surgery, a case of osteomyelitis, right at the point where the nurse was shining the light in the dream.
Wow.
There's a case I talk about in the book that has to do with 9/11, in which a security head at one of the towers actually had a dream of falling towers and planes and debris and crashing buildings, and it occurred independently to his wife as well. So they independently dreamed the same thing, and he chose to ignore it and died as a result. So if people start picking up on the same premonitions, especially in dreams, it's a real clue.
I think that that's a big thing when you say that independently and separately they had the same dream. That's a pretty big clue.
Yeah. Also, if dreams premonitions have to do with death, they should be given serious attention. Carl Jung, the psychiatrist, always said that if a dream has to do with death, take it seriously because you may not have a second chance. Well, I say it's just a heads up. You know, it doesn't mean that we're going to fall prey to death down the line, but it does mean that we ought to pay attention to what's going on in our life.
Now, a lot of neurologists still don't really believe in them, do they? Well, actually, a lot of people in general.
Boy, putting it mildly, neurologists generally run in the other direction from these things because they have been bamboozled by their training to say in advance that these things are impossible. So, you know, it's that old everybody knows thing. Everybody knows that these things can't happen, so they all the stories are bound to be bogus, and any proof is bound to be wrong. So,
well, here's interesting thing. Harriet Tubman, you know, who helped free slaves underground, many people don't know that she had premonitions and dreams and visions, and this is what helped her guide these people to safety. And a lot of people don't know that it was an early... I wonder if it was the early accident she had. Can you tell a little bit about that accident she had? And
Harriet Tubman led hundreds of slaves from the South up to the North to freedom in the years around the Civil War. As a young girl, she had dreams. She was clear about that, as she wrote about these later. But her dream life changed radically after she was hit in the head and almost killed by a slave overseer who threw a large iron weight at someone else and hit her. She had a depression in the skull. I mean, this was a major, major piece of cranial trauma. And after that, her dream life just flowered. She began to believe that she could fly over the earth and see things from afar very accurately. She would have what she called sudden sleeps, where she would just sink to the ground and have visions. And these things would prove to be valid. She would see escape routes where she would lead the slaves. She would see places in the river she could ford, and she would see cabins where she would be given safety with the slaves that she was leading to freedom. I mean, this is extremely
amazing.
It really is. And Harriet Tubman has one of the richest dream lives of anybody on record. And Robert Moss, whom you've interviewed several times on this program, actually, I have to give credit. Robert introduced me to Harriet Tubman, Harriet Tubman's story. So I want to say thanks to Robert.
Well, it's amazing to me that, you know, now a neurologist could say it was that accident and it did, but there's something so much bigger. I mean, how could we know these things, accident or not? How could we know these things, you know? I was really interested in premonition in animals. You talked about a little cat named Oscar. Would you share that? That was great.
A couple of years ago, Oscar the cat became the most famous pet in the world for a while because a courageous doctor named Dr. David Dosa wrote his story up in the most famous medical journal in the world, the New England Journal of Medicine. The deal is that there is a facility that cares for people with cognitive decline and diseases like dementia and other forms of and diseases like Alzheimer's and so on. And so Oscar is the pet cat on this particular ward in this nursing home facility. And he had a habit of curling up on the bed of people about 2 to 4 hours before they died.
Yeah.
He did this something like 20, 22 times in a row without missing. And the nursing home personnel, as well as the neurologist who served this ward, began to really keep track of this. And so the neurologist decided finally that this cat is doing something extraordinarily unusual. He never misses. He seems to have precognition about who's going to die invariably. So this cat never made a mistake. And so he wrote this case history of Oscar the cat in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it created a firestorm of controversy. I mean, you'd think people would be happy to hear about something this marvelous, but it really worked in the other direction. They interviewed all sorts of animal behavior experts, and not one, Joe, said, yeah, this cat seems to have premonition.
Well, I don't get that. I mean, that's, you look at the tsunami, I can't say the word, half tsunami.
Yeah.
And you look at how the animals knew that was coming ahead of time, and how did they know that? And, you know, they weren't killed, and they got away. And I think of times when I haven't been feeling well, how my cat will, her behavior will change, and she'll curl up to me differently, or she'll start needing me differently or something. So I don't see how people would find that so unbelievable.
Well, you know, cat owners don't find it unbelievable at all. But if you ask people who are intent on keeping all the stuff in the brain and ruling out premonitions, because everybody knows, you know, that old term again, everybody knows you can't see the future, then they just go into a tizzy when the whole possibility of premonitions is raised. I think everybody who doubts this ought to read Rupert Sheldrake's research looking at premonitions in animals. There's a great book called Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Returning Home, and other tales, which I think indisputably document premonitions in a variety of animals, not just cats, such as Oscar.
Oh, and you had the best stories in your book. I just want everybody to know how amazing this book is, The Power of Premonitions. And there's the section, too, on animals where you talked about an animal that went, how many miles was it, Larry? Was it 3,000 miles or something?
Yeah, well, I forget the exact mileage, but it was between 2 and 3,000 miles. It was between Indiana,
Oregon,
and Oregon.
So, that's like, what?
Yeah.
And the family moved, right?
The family moved to a new home in Oregon from their home in Indiana. And while they were going through Illinois, as I recall, Bobby the collie got lost. They couldn't find Bobby, and so they went on to the new home in Indiana. This dog had never been to the new home before, but about 6 months later, you know, there was the scratch at the door, and there's the collie who
That's incredible.
Found his way all the way from Indiana
to Oregon.
To
a house he'd never even seen before.
No, I mean, this was not a homing animal, you know. He didn't know where the home was. I actually had the opportunity to tell this story several years ago when I was talking about consciousness at a lecture I gave at the Smithsonian Institute. Mm-hmm. And here's the extent, Joe, that people will go to dismiss these things. There was an Army colonel who stood up in the Q&A session, and he said, "I know how the dog did it." He said, "It's pheromones." He said, you know, the people in Oregon who got there liberated these hormones, and they, you know, the dog sniffed out these hormones
from Indiana or Illinois or wherever.
Yeah, exactly. And I said, "Don't you think that's a little far-fetched?" And I said, "I mean, there's a lot of pheromones coming from the west toward the east. How did he sniff out the right the right smells?" And he said, "Oh no," he says, "it's perfect. The wind always blows from the west to the east, and this it happened." And I mean, what can you say to that? I mean, if somebody wants to believe that, they're believing in paranormal stuff, whether they admit it or not.
Yeah, that's funny.
I mean, that's just absolutely nutty, it seems to me.
You know, you wrote in your book as well, April 14th, 1865, Abraham Lincoln, it was in the Ford Theater in Washington, D.C. I never knew this. Back at the White House, at that moment, his usually gentle and quiet dog was just going berserk.
The dog went nuts. The dog disturbed everybody in the White House, all the servants. Actually, the account is that the people and the servants in the White House knew instantly that something was wrong with Lincoln. That was their premonition on seeing the dog's behavior. But this dog was very mild and gentle and never behaved like this. And he just went crazy about the time Lincoln was assassinated in the theater.
It's pretty amazing stuff. You know, there's so many situations. You talked, when going back to September, you know, 9/11, this was interesting to me, the vacancy rates on the planes. And I wanted to ask you, because I read about that in your book, and I wondered, were these vacancy rates kind of normal for that time of day and those routes, or was it unusual?
Yeah, let me just make clear to the listeners that the vacancy rates on those four planes was very high. Most people in America seem to have the image that there were four full planes that crashed on that day. But, well,
yeah.
I did too. But it wasn't that way at all. The vacancy rate on all those planes was between 74% and 84%. It evened out at about 79% to 80%. And if you Google dreams of 9/11, which I did at one point in researching this book, you come up with 12 million hits. There were a lot of people who found some reason not to travel that day. Now, is this unusual for those routes at this time of day? I don't know, because you can't get the data from the airlines to compare ridership rates in the preceding weeks and months.
Right.
Rupert Sheldrake tried to chase down the ridership data from American Airlines, and although they were cordial to him, they said they could not release the information because it had been impounded by the FBI. So I don't think we can know for sure if people's premonitions warned them away on that particular day. But I must say, it sure sounds like it. I don't get on many planes that are just 20% full.
No, I don't either. Especially, these weren't, you know, the small planes where it's two seats per side. I mean, these were big planes that held a lot of people, several hundred people.
Yeah, these were jumbo jets, yeah.
Why do some people have premonitions that help them avoid these events, these tragedies, while other people don't have the premonition?
Well, you can look at that in one of two ways. One is that premonitions are just not fair. You know, why should some people get them and others not? I don't know the answer to that, except possibly that any human faculty or talent varies between human beings. I mean, there are premonition prodigies who are just tuned in to this sort of thing. They seem to live in this domain. On the other hand, you know, there are people like the rest of us who are grateful for, you know, what the universe reveals to us, even though it's periodic. I don't find this very surprising, Joe, because if you look at practically any human talent, you know, there are huge variations. There are prodigies in athletics and, you know, math and music and science and anything. So I guess it's not surprising that we might see some people in premonitions who are prodigies, while the rest of us are sort of average.
That's true. You know, I was just sitting there playing before I called you, and we talked here, some classical pieces I recently wrote, and that's easy for me, but ask me to find my way around a new town, and that's not easy for me. Speaking of which, you talked about London cabbies, and I lived in London off and on a long time ago, and man, they really had to study there. And you talk a little bit about the parts of the brain that are used when people study this, and how GPS devices and information technology are actually changing.
And brain scans have been done on these people, and before they become cabbies, and then afterwards, after they master the knowledge. And what happens is amazing. Certain parts of their brain actually grow and get bigger as they learn all of these routes, which are absolutely daunting. And so the people who have looked into this lament the fact that they may lose this brain advantage, this actual anatomical change, which helps them, as if they begin to install GPS devices and route finders in their cabs. So I don't know if that has actually come to pass or not. I haven't been to London lately.
Yeah, I just think it's amazing that it can actually change the brain and other skills you have.
It brings up the possibility, which I raise in the book, whether or not people who are really good at sensing the future have different brains than the rest of us. They well may have different sensing devices, just simply because their brains are able to pick up on things more keenly than the rest of us. This is not known currently, however.
And sometimes people get fragments of something that's true, or maybe it's not literal, maybe it symbolizes something, or maybe it happens in the future, that fragment happens. So it's really interesting. I wanted to also, if you could mention to people some of the cautions. I thought that was kind of important. On page 169 of your book, some of the cautions that don't mix well with premonitions.
Yeah, people who have had problems with schizophrenia before and have problems even in their ordinary life distinguishing fantasy from fiction, from fact, really need to be cautious about inviting premonitions into their life. People who have had childhood abuse seem to not do well with this domain either. And people who have had problems with drug addiction should really think twice before they start inviting premonitions into their life and engaging in disciplines whereby they might cultivate these things. I mean, there are warnings that are appropriate, just like there are appropriate warnings for any medication people might take. I mean, there are downsides to this. I've talked about something I call PDS, psychic dependency syndrome, in which people are very reluctant to make decisions for themselves without cultivating a relationship with a psychic and asking them what they think before they make any moves.
And they're basing so much on this other person's belief system and whatever else they're telling them,
You know, they honor premonitions, but somebody else's.
Yeah.
They want to go find out what somebody else thinks about their future.
Yeah.
And I've known people who just do this to an almost pathological degree.
It's addicting, right? It's addicting.
It is, and you undercut your own wisdom if you fall into that trap, and I think that there are more people who actually do that than we probably know.
Yeah, because people wouldn't admit that.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
It did escalate to a national level when Nancy Reagan, during the Reagan years in the White House, consulted an astrologer in making out the president's schedule. So...
That's interesting, right? Astrology, because, I mean, I had an astrologer on the show really early on, and he was very good. There's some people that are very good, but no matter what it comes to with all these healers, even good healers, it's through their own experience that they're coming at your situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an exact science. I just don't think it's exact. And I think if you follow it too closely, you can actually create a life based on what somebody has told you and fulfill it, because you're creating the fulfillment based on what you've heard. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Sure. factor.
So we have to be really careful that sometimes what we think is a premonition maybe isn't, and maybe sometimes it's a fragment, maybe sometimes it is true, but you got to really use discernment to know that, and I think that's the big issue right there.
Discernment is a great term. Just because something seems like a premonition doesn't mean that it is, and so we need multiple sources of information.
Yeah.
That's the way to keep from being fooled here. Common sense is, you know, goes a long way in this area. Also, consultants, you know, people who are stable and are friends who care about us, you know, we can run things by them. Basically, caution is advised.
Yeah. Well, thanks for this great book, The Power of Premonitions, How Knowing the Future Can Shape Our Lives. Can you share your website?
www.dossey.com. That's D-O-S-S-E-Y twice, because my wife and I share the same website.
That's great. I love it. Thanks so much for being on the show. And this is a great book. I just finished it, so I have a lot of writing in it. You know how you do that?
Oh, yeah. Let's mutilate those books.
Yeah,
I love that.
I mutilate them. I underline things. I write notes. It's really cool. Well, thank you.
It's great. Thanks, Joe.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Larry Dossey, and again, his fabulous new book is called The Power of Premonitions, How Knowing the Future Can Shape Our Lives. You can pick up a copy at your local bookstore or online. I want to thank him so much for being on the show today. My name is Joe Davidson, and this is Zentertainment Talk Radio here on the web at www.zentertainment.org. Have a great week, and I will talk to all of you next time. Peace.